joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The late actor Christopher Reeve once said of his paralysis, "I am positive I will walk again." While he never saw his dream realized, new research is bringing hope to severely paralyzed patients and those with neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease. Scientist Mikhail Nikolaos has written a new book about his groundbreaking research. He explains how living brains can interface with machines. His book is titled Beyond Boundaries, and Mikhail Nikolaos joins me in the studio. Dr. Nikolaos is professor of neuroscience at Duke University and founder of Duke University's Center for Neuroengineering. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a message on Facebook or a tweet. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This research sounds like something right out of science fiction.
I guess so. It was a little bit of science fiction about 20 years ago, but it's becoming reality now.
When you say it's becoming reality now, how far has it progressed?
Yes, we have now been able to read large-scale brain activity, electrical signals coming from the brain, and decode messages that are embedded in these signals and transform them in digital commands that can be used by robotic devices or even virtual devices to enact the voluntary motor will of our subjects. And
Didn't it used to be that you would think of a particular part of the brain as doing a particular task, and now there is a whole new set of ideas about that?
Yeah, you just mentioned the greatest dogma of neuroscience for the last 100 years, the belief that particular parts of the brain were very highly specialized for a particular function. And well, what we have found in the last decade in this research is that that's not quite what goes on. There is more of a neuronal democracy. You know, neurons all over the brain are voting, albeit in different ways, to perform a particular behavior, to generate a particular behavior.
And I guess that the confirmation of that might be that when a particular part of the brain stops working, you have another part of the brain that could take over.
Exactly, exactly. There are a variety of studies for the last 20 years showing that the brain is very plastic, that he can adapt almost instantaneously to a lesion, either a central or a peripheral lesion. And the moment that lesion happens, the brain is trying to reroute these signals, these electrical signals, to restore the best possible next solution for the problem that has emerged.
So is it possible that when one has a serious brain injury, say one is in an automobile accident or has a terrific spinal injury, as did Christopher Reeve, that the kind of experimentation you're doing could actually sort of push these neurons into activity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We are trying to take advantage of plasticity, of brain plasticity. The whole idea of this research is to create a bypass through the lesion using an interface between the brain and machines, using a computational electronic and robotic interfaces that will allow what is left of the brain that is working properly to try to generate the signals that are necessary for this interface to restore function and behaviors, particularly motor behaviors.
Well, take motor behaviors such as Parkinson's disease. How would you imagine your work might go on to help those people.
Yeah, we have recently, about 2 years ago, published a study showing a potential new therapy for Parkinson's disease that takes advantage of an interface with the brain. Today, as you know, patients that reach a very high or important level of motor impairment due to Parkinson's disease have very few options. One of them is a surgical procedure called deep brain stimulation that, you know, improves in a great number of patients their symptoms, but is an invasive procedure and is a tough procedure. Not every patient can take it. It's a small percentage of the patients that can have it.
And not every patient improves.
And not every patient improves, exactly. And, of course, the effects can go down with time. You know, the improvement can decline over time. Well, we discover, because of this new view of the brain, this distributed view of the brain, this collective view of the brain, that we could come in the back, in the spinal cord, in animals, animals that have Parkinson-like syndrome, and stimulate the surface of the spinal cord here, where you have a million fibers going up to the brain to take a message to the brain and get the same effects that you get going deep into the brain with the deep brain stimulation technique. So in our animals, in rodents, we were able to basically alleviate all the Parkinson's symptoms by doing the same stimulation, the same electrical stimulation that today we do deep in the brain.
But
right
what
here.
You're saying is your approach is non-invasive?
Well, it's semi-invasive because you just need to go under the bone.
Okay.
But it's so simple and it's so easy and it's so inexpensive that could be affordable pretty much by everybody, and it could be done if it proves to be, you know, appropriate. And we already have primate data suggesting that it works in primates too. Preliminary data is supporting the same results that we got in rodents. That surgery could be done almost at the moment of diagnosis. So you could have a patient that could receive this stimulator, and that's an interface. That's an interface, a brain interface, that could basically keep the patient from degrading. At least the symptoms would be under control much early on, together with the pharmacological therapy, or a much smaller dose of what is used today.
Interesting. Tell me about these trials with monkeys planting small electrodes that record these signals from the neurons.
Yes, you mentioned Mr. Reeves, and I met him way back, you know, when we were starting this research, and that was very, very moving day because I mentioned to him that my dream was like his. I had seen so many patients when I was in medical school back in Brazil before joining Duke with paralysis that for a long time we thought about an idea, and that's exactly what you mentioned. We discovered that if we can record the electrical brainstorms that are generated in the brain, in the cortex, the motor cortex, you know, where the plans for us to move are generated half a second before we even start moving.
Huh.
That's what the brain does.
Yeah.
The brain is about the future. It plans the future of our motion. And during that window, half a second or so, we discovered in the last 10 years that we could record these electrical signals that encode a motor behavior, decode this message, translate this message into digital commands, and send these digital commands to a robotic arm, a robotic leg, a virtual body, or a computational tool, so that that subject, a monkey in this case, could control, just by thinking, the movements of these devices, these artificial devices. So basically, the monkey could enact its voluntary motor will just by thinking.
Just by thinking.
Yes. That's the one of the sentences that I think is the key of all this work.
Miguel Nicolelis, he is a professor of neuroscience at Duke University, founder of Duke Center for Neuroengineering. His new book is titled Beyond Boundaries, The New Neuroscience of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Do call 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, you had another experiment with a monkey, a rhesus monkey called Aurora.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Yeah, Aurora has become perhaps the most famous actress or monkey in this research field. She's known all over the world because she was one of the first primates to actually do what we just discussed. She was able to control a robotic arm that played a video game for her, and she first learned to play this video game with her own arm, controlling a joystick. And every time she got the game right, she would get a drop of fruit juice, and she would do anything for that fruit juice. She loved it, and she drank, you know, liters of it per day. And once she learned to play the video game, at the same time that she was learning, we were recording her brain activity and making our computers learn to reproduce her arm movements into a robotic device that was in another room. So after a few weeks, we just, you know, kindly removed the joystick and let Aurora realize that now to play the game, she didn't need to move her body at all. She just had to imagine the movements that she had to make.
And that would move.
And the robotic arm would move and would control a computer cursor that would play the game for her. So I have these videos, and I have played these videos all over the world. And in our website, you know, we're putting these videos, beyondboundariesnicoleellis.net. And it's one of the most amazing moments of my life because you see the monkey just relaxing. And all of a sudden, the cursor continues to move. And we see the robotic arm moving as she would move her arm.
And we will have that website attached to our own at drshow.org. Right now, join us, 800-433-8850. And we're back with a fascinating discussion about science, what's happening, with Dr. Miguel Nicoleellis. He is a professor of neuroscience at Duke University, founder of Duke Center for Neuroengineering. He's written a book about his work. It's titled Beyond Boundaries, The New Neuroscience of Connecting Brains with Machines and How It Will Change Our Lives. Here's an email, Dr. Nicoleellis, from Robin, who says, I have a child with autism and ADHD. Can you speak a little about how this research could point to new ways to rewire the brains of these children? I'm thinking of neurofeedback in particular.
Yes, the research we just mentioned about motor restoring motor functions is not really related to these neurological dysfunctions. It's not directly related. But neurofeedback is an area that is gaining a lot of interest recently. You know, this started in the late 60s. There was a lot of experiments on people trying to understand what would happen when you manipulate the information that goes back to the brain from the environment. And that somehow died out for a long time. And because of this research on brain-machine interface, and because we realized that the feedback that you send from these devices back to the brain is so important, the issue of how you handle feedback to retrain the central nervous system, has acquired a tremendous new interest. So I don't particularly work on these fields, in these particular disorders.
With autism or ADHD.
But I have seen over the last few years a lot of people discussing alternative methods, alternative potential therapies, using feedback. And this is going to come in a variety of formats. And the interesting thing is, what I discuss in the book is that we are now realizing that the brain is not the passive device that we thought in the past. For 100 years, we thought the brain was just receiving information from the environment and decoding it. In reality, the brain is a major simulator of reality. The brain acquires information and statistics of the world as we are growing up and creates a whole model of who we are and a model of reality that is out there. So the brain has a point of view, continuous point of view of everything that is about to happen. So when you accept that, you change the way you interact with the brain.
I'm thinking back to that rhesus monkey and the fact that you were encoding the work of the neurons in her brain and translating them so that with just her mode of thinking, she could actually move that arm. How can that be?
Oh, it was actually, when we started, people thought that we were completely crazy.
Yeah.
That would never work.
Yeah.
Right? And I started this work with my postdoctoral mentor, John Chapin, who is one of the greatest neuroscientists I ever met in my life. And when we did the first experiments in his lab in rats, and the rats got to get water just by thinking, because a robot lever would bring the water to their mouth, you know, and we showed these movies, people thought this is completely crazy. That's what we move into monkeys, because we wanted demonstrations that were much more complex of the movements much more complex than just something moving back and forth. Basically, what we realize is that if you are recording enough neurons, and the surprise here is that out of the billions, hundreds of billions of neurons that we have in the brain, if you have a few hundred neurons recorded simultaneously, you already can reproduce some of these simple motor behaviors, what tells you a lot about how the brain works. You know, it challenges a lot of the theories that are out there. Now we realize that if we get to a few thousand neurons, tens of thousands of neurons, 20, 30,000 neurons, we may be able to move a whole robotic body. So we could have a quadriplegic patient dressed up in this robotic vest that I call an exoskeleton that you have with you.
I have a photograph of this in front of me, and we will try to put this on our website.
Yes, and this is created by my great friend Gordon Cheng at the Technical University of Munich that is collaborating with us on this project called the Walk Again Project. It's an international nonprofit project to make someone walk again in the next 3.5 years using this device. So we realized that if we can get to a few thousand neurons, that's a tiny little fraction of what you have in the brain, we would be able to make this subject, a quadriplegic patient, control this whole body and move again, move the whole body again.
By thinking. So the brain signals are recorded by implanted electrodes transmitted wirelessly to receptors throughout this entire prosthetic. So by thinking about this, you will be able to move.
And it will be a bidirectional interaction, because this vest also has sensory receptors. So as the patient steps on the ground, there will be a signal coming from the exoskeleton back to the patient's brain, informing, like if it was a touch, because these patients also lose the ability to sense the world, right?
But Dr. Nicolaides, this looks pretty substantial. This looks like a robot itself.
Absolutely, but there is a vest. It's a vest. You will dress it every morning, and you will, for 5 minutes, get used to it. And there's one caveat that is very interesting. I discussed some research done by many groups around the world in one of the chapters here. that strongly suggest, based on studies on tools, so athletes that use, you know, tools to play sports, like tennis
racket,
players, exactly. Uh-huh. All the evidence, or Formula One racers, people that are racing these pretty fast cars, and they're shaped on the shape of their body, so they sit in something that is very tight, so they can really control the car very closely. Well, all the research suggests that our brains assimilate these tools as part of this model that the brain creates that defines who we are, the model of the self. So these tools become extensions of us. So our research suggests that this vest will become a new body for that subject. The brain will assimilate that as the new body of that person. So after a few months of use, that will be a natural thing, as much natural, as natural as if we were, both of us, walking out in the street.
And here is an email to follow up on exactly that. It's from Jim in St. Louis, Missouri. He says, how does the current research on the functioning of the human brain help or hinder us in confirming or defining what has for centuries been called the soul? For that matter, whether animals with brains also have souls.
Yeah, I don't believe in souls. I believe in the self. And I do believe that over evolution, the self was slowly coming, emerging, and then there was a big quantum leap as we move from lower mammals to primates and from primates to us. And certainly the self is an emergent property of these billions of neurons interacting to produce what we believe is our body.
Are the numbers of neurons in our brains increasing?
Oh, yes. Of course, through the evolution, yes, but not in our brains. In our brains, we are born with pretty much the neurons that we are going to have over our lives. But what matters more than perhaps the total number is how these neurons connect to each other, and how they interact with each other through these connections. And that's where you get a lot of plasticity. Imagine if you have an airline set of hubs over the United States, and let's say Chicago goes down because of a snowstorm. You have to reroute your flights, right? You cannot really just stop everything. You go to St. Louis, you go to other places. That's the brain does dynamically all the time, in a much larger scale, of course.
Now, I have something called spasmodic dysphonia, which affects the movement of my vocal cords to the point where they clench when they're not supposed to clench. Now, that might be called a kind of paralysis of the vocal cords stemming from incorrect messages from the basal ganglia mm-hmm. of the brain. At least that's what I've been told.
Yes.
And you said earlier that it takes a half second for us to react to the brain's message. Is that why it's so hard for me to initiate the first word?
Yes, yeah. In fact, there is this period. I say half a second because I'm including all the planning, all the early stages of these electrical signals, you know, emerging in different areas of the brain and combining themselves to go down to the neurons that will control directly our muscles. So there's all this planning that goes on, and even before you're conscious that you are going to say what I'm saying right now, my brain has created all this motor program that goes to my larynx to produce the sequence of movements that are needed for me to speak and produce these sounds. So there is that space of planning where you engage the higher mm-hmm. centers, the mm-hmm. cortex, and as you mm-hmm. mentioned, these deep neurons called the basal ganglia, these clusters of cells. And anything that goes wrong in that planning or in these transmission lines, these nerves that carry these signals all the way to the muscles, any delay on the lines or any synchronization that is beyond what you want will generate a problem. So Parkinson's disease, for instance, we discover with these studies that we just mentioned in the beginning that Parkinson's, if you look at the brain activity of animals with Parkinson's and now with patients, what you see is that neurons are all firing together in these regions, in the basal ganglia and even in the cortex, they are very synchronous. They are all firing at the same time.
And should not
they be. They should not. No, they should be much more chaotic.
How
they should be much more disorganized. But because they get so organized and they all fire all at the same time, you start having the symptoms that you see. You start having the tremors, the difficulty to move. So what we discover is that when you stimulate the spinal cord, like I mentioned before, what happens is a disorganization of disorder. You introduce some sort of chaos in disorder, and that is when the brain works okay.
And out of chaos comes
organization. And that's the beauty of it.
That really is fascinating. Miguel Nicolelis, he is a professor of neuroscience at Duke University, founder of Duke Center for Neuroengineering. His new book is titled Beyond Boundaries. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a message on Facebook or a tweet. Let's go first to Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Good morning, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My husband is 75 years old and suffering from Parkinson's disease and is now in rehab for a stroke that has affected his left side.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He has researched deep brain stimulation and found he's not a candidate because the L-DOPA did not correct or lessen his tremors. And he needs his right hand and arm to be without tremor since that's the only arm that he can use now. I'm wondering if the doctor's work would benefit, would he be a candidate for this project?
Well, good morning. I was talking before the show. My grandfather had Parkinson's disease, and somewhat similar to what you described, you know, many years ago, but the clinical picture that you described is very similar. We don't know yet how many or what kind of patients will benefit or which ones will not benefit from the dorsal column stimulation because we are still in the experimental phase of this technique.
We have not moved to humans.
No, not yet. Yes, we have just crossed the half of our primate studies with very good results. We have reproduced everything that we saw in rodents in our primate studies, but we have to conclude the primate studies before we start any clinical assessment of the technique. What we have seen is that in severe cases of Parkinson's syndrome in animals, because we cannot call that Parkinson's disease because it's an animal model of the disease, we were able to reverse primarily the difficulty of locomotion and the difficulty to start the movements. And that was very encouraging. But I wouldn't, you know, move to say what type of patient would benefit right now because we simply don't know.
So part of the problem with those who have Parkinson's is exactly my problem, initiation.
Yes, yes. The difficulty to initiate
move.
The movements, yes.
Indeed. Carol, I hope that is some comfort to you. However, it does sound as though it's going to be a while before that comes to help human beings themselves. How long would you say?
Well, we are about to finish this year the primate studies in the next few months. So I'm hopeful the next year, 2012, we can start the clinical assessment of the technique. And that will be done in multiple countries simultaneously because there are several neurosurgical centers very interested in this technique. And a few have already started in desperate cases to try. In Canada, for instance, I heard of one case in Europe. So I think that next year we will start, the clinical assessment.
Interesting. Yeah. And do you see, have you seen any negative side effects with these creatures?
Yeah, so far we haven't seen it because this is so superficial and is so much and a stimulation of fibers that carry normal tactile information. So probably in the beginning there is a tingling sensation, but that goes away because the brain adapts to that kind of sensation after a while.
When you say this stimulant has to go beneath the bone.
Yeah, the vertebra. So you just put this on the surface of the spinal cord.
I see. All right. We'll take a short break here. Miguel Nicolelis, and that name is spelled Nicolelis. The book has a simple title. It's Beyond Boundaries.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Reputation.com, with tools to monitor and protect the online reputations of doctors, lawyers, and business professionals. Learn more at Reputation.com. By Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. International news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories before the weekend. Join us for the Friday News Roundup. We're back talking with Miguel Nicolelis about his new and fascinating work, a very thorough description of which is entered into his new book, Beyond Boundaries. He is professor of neuroscience at Duke University, founder of Duke Center for Neuroengineering. Stuart is listening from WMFE in St. Petersburg, Florida. He says, do the brainstorms that are transmitted as signals differ between species or individuals? And if they do they differ with age and wisdom?
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
That's a
very good question, yes. The principles of these brainstorms are very similar. So the principles in mammals and primates and humans that generate these storms are very similar because they're electrical storms that liberate some chemicals that allow neurons to interact with each other. But the details of these storms from person to person differ. So the general principles, and we have listed here 10 principles in the book that over 25 years we have experimentally demonstrated, they seem to be valid from species to species, from rodents to primates to, and now we are about to test these in humans, of course. But within these principles, there is this uniqueness of each of us. You know, what I like to say is that at the same time, the brain tells us that at the same time that each of us is unique, it shows that each of us belongs to the same thing. You know, we have a common language of interacting and thinking and generating our feelings and emotions and predictions of the future and memories of the past. And yet, within these common principles, there is room for each of us to be a unique brain history that will never, ever repeat itself in the universe. There is no chance that a life like any of ours is going to be repeated.
Well, we may actually be able to voice our thoughts. But what about whales? What about dolphins? What about these rhesus monkeys who cannot relay to you orally,
yes,
what they are thinking, but can in other ways?
That's another very interesting question. I think verbally, we, as you said, that we can relate our thoughts. We can relate just a very small fraction
of what's going
of what
on
is going on,
here.
And is in very imprecise ways. Language, in fact, I discuss the views of few philosophers and neuroscientists from way back, and some contemporary neurophysiologists, that language, our problems interpreting the brain, is that the way we have to describe the brain is either language or written language. So we really don't have words to describe the functions, the probabilistic functions that go on in our heads. So that's a very nice point. I actually propose that way ahead in the future, we may be able to express ourselves beyond language. We may be able to express ourselves by actually broadcasting our thoughts and communicating our impressions, emotions, and views in a very different way.
And perhaps those whales are communicating their thoughts in ways that we simply don't understand.
Well, they certainly have ways to communicate among themselves that the people have been studying for a long time.
Right.
But what I like to say is that this research, the possibility of reading electrical signals from the brain and interfacing these with machines will actually liberate the brain. We'll liberate the brain from the constraints of language, or the constraints of the body, and our thoughts will have, you know, a free access to, you know, very different ways to express themselves.
In your lifetime?
I think so. I actually think so, that in the next 30 years, I hope to reach that 80, we will see things that amaze us.
All right, let's go to Jeremy. He's in Seattle, Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, the question, and even as you were talking about the language barriers there, is how is it that you isolate the neurons that are firing in the brain and the connection there to translate that abstractness to the point where you can, without hardwire connection through the central nervous system, maintain some sort of control over a machine? How is it that you overcome those challenges to the point where, with, you know, distracted focus that the brain has, is it that the subject simply has to, with determined focus, think about what they're trying to do? Or is it that you're really able to isolate the neurons that are the ones that are responsible for achieving the command that you and the operation of the machine that you're trying to do? So I was wondering if the doctor could speak to those and other challenges in that regard.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, that's a wonderful question because it touches directly on the issue that prevented most people of doing the kind of experiments that we did, you know, because people thought that you had to find the precise neurons, these right cells in the middle of that huge ocean, huge forest, find the trees that actually had the goods to produce these motor behaviors. We found out that is not the case. You just go generally to areas that we know are involved in motor coding or generating motor commands, you drop these electrodes. They are hair-like sensors, very thin sensors that you just introduce a few millimeters in the brain. In the future, it's going to be like a heart pacemaker, very similar. You just introduce these hairs into the brain, a few millimeters, and what we realize is that if you sample enough neurons, hundreds of them, you don't need to fish for the cardinal.
The
message is widely distributed across all the cells. That's the reason I call it a neuronal democracy. Things are all over the place. They're floating all over the place. And then you record them. If you have enough mass of neurons being recorded, you will get the signals you need.
Professor Nicolelis, we've had a number of emails asking about, what about fears of Big Brother?
Oh, yeah. This is always the case when new technology comes. And it's up to society, of course, to regulate the use of new technology. I like to say that when I was in medical school back in Brazil, and I work on the busiest emergency room that exists in the world every night when I was an intern, then my teachers used to come to me and say, you know, if everything fails, here you have a big pen, and the cap of the pen has this little tip. You can use this to make a tracheostomy and save someone's life. So you can use any tool, anything, for good and for bad things. And that's the reason science and scientists have to inform society continuously of the details of what they're discovering and what are the limits and what are the potential harmful ways in which that technology could be used. That's the reason, one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I thought it was very important to diffuse these fears, because there's so much good that can come out of this technology and to help millions of people.
But would you also agree that there's a fair amount of ill use to which it could be put?
Oh, certainly. It could happen, of course. It could. Although the technology that we have today available right now would not allow the science fiction scenarios to happen.
All right. Let's go to Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Maurice.
Good morning. Doctor, I have a question for you, and I agree with ethics. I mean, you're always going to have a question of ethics, and like you said, there's always something that could be used for good or for bad, but hopefully we err on the side of good. But two questions, Doc. At what age did you become interested in neuroscience, and what was the stimulus that caused that to happen? And then the second question is, children, are there programs out there for our future neuroscientists, whether they're in the United States, whether in Brazil, whether in Japan, where are there programs that children that are in grade school and high school can get involved in, organized programs that would pique their curiosity and hopefully drive our youth into the neuroscience sector? Because it just seems like our country right now, the United States, is not producing as much scientists. There's not so much interest. And I just think that there should be something out there, something more prevalent that's organized from early stage.
You know, Maurice, we did a program just a couple of weeks ago on robotics and how high school children are getting involved in building robots for class projects and competing on a national and even a world stage. Now, high school may be too late for what you're talking about. What about younger children?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. I got involved I knew that I would be a scientist when I was growing up in Brazil watching the Apollo program. And I was 5, 6 years old, and I was following every single mission. I was plotting it on atlases. I was watching as much as I could. There was no internet, but you know, I was reading every drop of it.
With the help of parents?
My grandmother.
Your grandmother.
My grandmother and I knew where Neil Armstrong was about to land before he landed there. You know, and we amazed the Brazilians, you know, in our neighborhood by saying, oh, we knew that would happen. And in any event, I was 7, and I read a book at that time by Isaac Asimov called The Brain. And there was somewhere
Fascinating man.
Yeah. I was one of my heroes at that time. And he said there's only one thing that compares to the universe, that is the brain. And that got me, forever. Well, it's very nice that you mentioned this, because for the last 10 years, I have been running a program in Brazil for children, a science education program that is really becoming a major initiative in Brazil. And I think that could be extremely useful here in the United States, because I agree totally what you said. High school is too late. Scientists, they are groomed in the credo and in the early days of childhood.
How did you get them
passion? Passion. Science is about passion. It's about being a child forever. It's about being paid to be a child forever. And it's one of the greatest professions you can have, because people trust you, society, the taxpayer, trust you to come up with solutions for humanity while you are there really acting like a kid.
But you know, when I was, again, this is a little later, a freshman in high school, what did we do in science but start cutting up frogs?
Yeah, yeah.
Please.
Yes. No, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Our kids, they start, this program is called Education for Life in Brazil. And it started with 1,000 kids in the poorest part of the country. And it's now going to become a curriculum for more than 1 million kids in Brazil.
Give me an idea of what's contained in the program.
It's all, yeah, we started elementary school level, and we are going all the way back to 4 years old. We discovered that we can start as early as you can imagine, and it's playful. You learn science by doing science. You learn the big concepts of science in laboratories for children, created for children, in which children get engaged into demonstrating the scientific method at work by doing scientific work like I do in my lab. And that is a revolution. You get people engaged into this, and math and science, chemistry, physics becomes playful.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Severna Park, Maryland. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning, Diane. I didn't hear any discussion about lesions from brain tumors. I have a granddaughter and a daughter who have suffered some motor impairment, some cognitive impairment. And I was just wondering if there's any research being done in that area.
Yes, although in our animals, in animal work, we have not simulated this type of lesions. One of the future applications we hope, of course, to use brain-machine interfaces for is to rehabilitation of patients that have lost brain tissue or have exactly what you described, a tumor that destroys areas of the brain. So one of the solutions that is envisioned is to use the other hemisphere or retrain other areas of the brain to try to restore some of the functions that have been lost through the disease.
You know, that takes me to a question about things like hip replacement or broken arms or, you know, something that happens to a lot of people. Is there any indication in your mind or in your work that the brain does have the ability to heal the body?
Well, certainly the brain remaps the body. So once you have, for instance, there's one phenomenon that you may have heard of that is one of the most prevalent phenomena in neurology that is called phantom limb pain. So you have missed a part of your body through an amputation, let's say, traumatic or because of, you know, your clinical need. In 80 to 90% of the patients, that part of the body is still felt. The patient reports not only that he can feel that limb that is gone, moving or sensations coming from the hand that doesn't exist anymore, or even pain. And imagine having pain, excruciating pain, that cannot be treated by almost anything, in a part of you that doesn't exist anymore. So that's one of the most terrifying things that I have seen way back in medical school. And it has been with us since the medieval ages, you know. And only recently, a few scientists have realized, Dr. Ramachandran at the University of San Diego, for instance, is the pioneer on this, that to perhaps to treat that excruciating pain and that phantom sensation, you have to fool the brain. So he has shown that if you project with mirrors an image of the other limb that is still present in the stump, that, you know, so that the person has a feeling, if you put both of your arms in a box and the box has mirrors that project the image,
the other arm,
on the other, and the person sees the arm back there, the pain goes away. The phantom sensation goes away. The brain thinks, okay, I have the missing part back. It's there. So I don't need to generate this weird sensation, this alarm that something is, you know, is wrong, or these memories of that part of the body. That,
so the brain can be tricked.
Yes, because the brain is a simulator. And if you trick the way the brain creates the simulation, you may be able to treat a lot of things that we couldn't, because we are treating the brain not properly.
Well, I'm sure you and I could go on for hours. Fascinating
Thank you
discussion.
Very much.
Thank you so much for being here. There's a link at drshow.org to Dr. Miguel Nicolelis. His new book is titled Beyond Boundaries. Congratulations. Come back and see us when the work continues.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ESA.